If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed.
The early 1960s saw the British establishment facing a challenging new landscape. The Beatles were storming the barricades of popular music. Harold Wilson was bringing a distinctive new voice to the political arena. And the Profumo affair was throwing a harsh new light on standards in public life. These developments are the focus of David Kynaston's latest book, A Northern Wind, Britain from 1962 to 65. Here, in conversation with Spencer Mizzen, he charts an era of rapid change, but also of enduring conservatism.
Hi, David. Thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you. Pleasure.
Your new book is called A Northern Wind, Britain 1962 to 65. My first question to you, David, is why that choice of title? What does the northern wind in the title refer to?
It's a double reference, really, arguably for two really big events or phenomena of this 2.5 years I cover in terms of a narrative are, on the one hand, the Beatles, who exploded in 1963 in a way really almost in any genre, but certainly in terms of pop music, hard to think of anything comparable. I mean, they were virtually unknown at the start of 1963. By November 63, when they appeared on the Royal Variety Performance, they had become a national institution in the space of, what, 10 or 11 months. And obviously, they were from Liverpool, and it was that very distinctive Mersey sound and so on. And I think it was part of their secret, their formula, as it were, that they weren't from London. They were from the north. That gave them a slightly rougher edge and so on, and freshness, I think. So, yeah, in terms of coming back to a northern wind. So on the one hand, the wind blowing from Merseyside with the Beatles. But the other crucial thing in terms of politics was that this was when, firstly, in early 63, Harold Wilson became leader of the opposition after Hugh Gaitskell's death, and then became prime minister as a result of the election in October 64. And Wilson was so different as in terms of his background as a type of leader, not only in terms of being a prime minister, whereas there have been all the sort of old Etonian conservative predecessors and so on, but actually rather different in terms of being a Labour leader, because his predecessor, Hugh Gaitskell, had been at Winchester, was a Wickhamist. Gaitskell's predecessor, Clement Attlee, had been to Haileybury and was a very loyal old Haileyburian, if that's the right word. Whereas Wilson, classic northern grammar school meritocrat with a bit of a Yorkshire accent. And so wholly different, really, from anything in terms of the two main parties that has been around since the war. And there was, in terms of the sort of the zeitgeist of that moment, 63-64, it really felt at the time that the Beatles and the Wilson kind of came together, something new, something fresh.
Now, I guess thousands and thousands of books have been written about the Beatles down the years. I mean, During your research into this period and into them specifically, did anything you came across really surprise you? Did you feel that you unearthed something particularly new about them?
Yeah, I think I'd answer that in two ways, actually. Firstly, I was trying really not to do just another version of the Beatles' rise to this extraordinary fame in a sort of, as it were, top-down way. So it's not a study of the Beatles themselves or how the songs were written or the role of George Martin or whatever it might be. I tried to do it in terms of, as it were, bottom-up and getting fans' reactions and across-society reactions, you know, because there were some people who didn't, you know, I used diaries and so on for that. It was quite hard to do, actually. I think I managed a sort of, you know, respectable account with some interest and some novelty in terms of the Beatles' rise through that, mainly memories, recollections of fans and so on, and a certain amount of contemporary reaction as well. But you ask, was there something that sort of surprised me? Well, I did have a bit of a moment, actually. And obviously, in my account of 1963, the Profumo affair looms large, and maybe we'll come back to that, I guess. But the sacrificial victim, and it was a terrible story, and it was the British establishment at its very worst. The sacrificial victim of the whole thing was Stephen Ward, the man who introduced Jack Profumo to Christine Keeler and was a sort of society osteopath and so on. And he was made the sacrificial victim. And it was a show trial, really, at the Old Bailey. And it reached the point where the judge started his summing up. And it was so clearly biased against Ward that that night he took a heavy overdose, lost consciousness, and died 2 or 3 days later on a Saturday, first Saturday of August 63. And it just happened that that Saturday evening, a very warm early August evening in Liverpool, was actually, as it turned out, the last time the Beatles played at the Cavern. And it was really hot and sweaty inside the Cavern. And the legal capacity in terms of what fire hazard and whatever was about 250. But in fact, there were about 500 crammed in. And I'd say the sort of sweat was sort of dripping down the walls and so on. And by the time the Beatles came on, about 5 or 6 local acts played first. And then the Beatles came on at the end. And it was probably about 10 o'clock or 10:30 or something. And anyway, there was a power fault, they were playing, and there was a power fault, so they had to stop. At which point, Paul McCartney picked up an acoustic guitar and started singing When I'm 64. And When I'm 64, of course, didn't appear until Sgt. Pepper 4 years later. And as I think I say in the book, it's a sort of time-bending moment. But apparently Paul had written the song quite early, and it is said he was saving it up to record it for the time when his father became 64. So, and that apparently was, so to said anyway. And I just found it was very resonant because Stephen Ward was 50 when he died, effectively committed suicide. And obviously he never lived to hear the song, never lived to be 64. And somehow it just seemed a rather poignant conjunction.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned the Profumo affair there. I mean, let's talk a little bit about it. I mean, how momentous was this affair in the early 60s history of Britain? I mean, what did it say about the establishment's relationship with the media and the British people more generally?
Yeah, I think it was important. Some people thought of time, oh, perhaps it's overblown or so on. I don't think so, really, because I mean, it came at a time when the establishment was already being questioned quite hard. And the two obvious examples of that in terms of the media, as it were Beyond the Fringe, 1960, making fun of all sorts of sacred cows rather brilliantly. And then that was the week that was TW3, which had begun in the autumn of 62. And it was the hypocrisy, really, that Profumo solemnly denied in Parliament that he'd had an affair with Keeler. And the press, on the whole, the tabloids went on pushing and questioning, whereas the broadsheets took him at his own word. Even The Guardian, which he just sort of said, after Profumo had made his statement denying the affair, The Guardian next day said something like, well, I think we should just let sleeping dogs lie and not get into this rather sort of, you know, prurient kind of stuff. It took a very high-minded approach, which wasn't entirely helpful. And then Profumo, 2 months later, early June 63, had to admit he had lied and resign. And then Ward was made into the scapegoat, and Christine Keeler herself was made into a scapegoat. And eventually, on pretty trumped-up charges to do with another case, went to prison in late 63 for 6 months. And it just made government and establishment look hypocritical and look terribly out of touch as well, I think. The really fascinating thing in terms of the politics is the really interesting thing about this period that the book covers is this, that the zeitgeist with, you know, anti-establishment stuff beyond the fringe, TW3, Private Eye, the rise of the North, the Beatles, Irreverent, and so on, all seem to be pointing towards upsetting the apple cart, as it were, different from the 1950s, the rather staid 1950s, etc. And the Tories, when Macmillan resigns in October 63, the Tories completely counterintuitively, really, choose Alec Douglas Hume, who has no kind of knowledge of economics. It's such a sort of old-fashioned gent and toff, basically. And all he really knows about is diplomacy, and he had been foreign secretary and so on, and doesn't really have a clue how people live in the Britain of 1963. And everything would seem to point, as were the opinion polls at that time, towards a thumping Labour win at the next election. And then when it actually came to the election, October the 15th, 1964, Labour barely scraped home with an overall majority of 3 or 4. And, you know, how does one explain this? And I think my essential explanation is that Britain still was a far more old-fashioned, socially conservative and deferential and kind of class-bound country than perhaps people assumed. And that tends to fit in with my general approach to post-war Britain in the books I've been writing. And, you know, it's so easy to read off what's happening in the metropolis, what's happening in London or the big cities, you read off to the entire country. And that isn't necessarily so. And of course, we found that out very much with the Brexit vote in 2016, which was very much in the north, for example, the cities tended to vote Remain, but it was the towns, as it were, the left behind towns, etc., with a sort of older fashioned way of life and so on, and probably an older demographic who voted Leave. And it was a bit like that in 64. And the young Tariq Ali, who would become very famous later in the 60s as a sort of student leader, and the big demonstration in 68 outside the American Embassy at Grosvenor Square against the Vietnam War, and became a sort of byword in the late 60s for student radicalism and so on. At the time of the election, he was an undergraduate at Oxford, and he did a bit of canvassing for Labour. And he says in his autobiography that doing that canvassing, often older people on the doorstep would say to him, oh, I think I'll vote for Tory. For Sir Alec, he seems a thoroughly nice chap and a very decent gentleman and experienced and so on. And so deference, basically, was far from dead at this time. And generally, I do think social historians, it's very easy to overrate the pace of change. And I think that's partly because, well, it's a particular problem, I think, with the 60s. And it's partly because we have such strong visual images of the 60s. And we have a very youth-oriented perspective on the 60s. And actually, in my first paragraph of the book, I kind of end the paragraph by mentioning my grandparents, my father's parents, who lived in a small town in Shropshire. And I think they had heard of the Beatles. I'm almost sure they'd never heard of the Rolling Stones. And I say, and I mean it, you know, the 60s was just as much their 60s as anyone else. You know, if one's trying to write a broadly, as it were, democratic, inclusive, everyone's life is of equal value, which surely has to be one's, as it were, philosophical starting point writing social history, then I'm very keen that it's not an overly youthist account of the 60s. While at the same time, inevitably, I kind of want to have a bit of fun with all that. And why not? Because it was part of it and something did change. But one shouldn't overestimate the reach of, as it were, in inverted commas, the 60s.
So kind of related to that point, I mean, many people look back at the 60s with a great deal of affection. I mean, there's quite a lot of nostalgia swirling around my own father. He was in his late teens in the period you cover in your latest book, and he certainly has a lot of nostalgia for that period. But I mean, what did you find when you researched the book? I mean, did you get the sense that Britain was a country that was feeling pretty good about itself?
Yes, broadly. I think that's right. And that's largely, I suspect, because the strongest single, as it were, indicator of whether a country is feeling good about itself has to be economic. And there's this weird double thing going on through in the 60s and to some extent the 70s. But on the one hand, living standards were rising significantly year on year. People had more disposable income and a better standard of life and so on. And then back in 1957, Macmillan had famously said, "You've never had it so good." And with qualifications, because there was actually this thing in the mid-60s, the so-called rediscovery of poverty, and someone like Ken Loach making that famous television film, Kathy Come Home, which led to the start of Shelter, that housing organisation. There were still pockets of poverty, and that's an important part of the story. But broadly, most people's living standards were improving. And of course, it was a time of full employment. So on the whole, that's what people like. And it's entirely understandable. But the weird thing, of course, is that simultaneously, we were in relative economic decline compared with rival countries, of which Germany would be the most obvious example, West Germany as it was then. And that was the discourse of economic decline just dominates, well, certainly by the early 60s, through to arguably probably into the 80s. You know, I mean, successive elections, opposition leaders, you know, whether it's Wilson in 64 or Heath in 1970 or Thatcher in 79, will basically say we can, you know, we'll be promising we can do something and we can reverse this relative economic decline. But I think on the whole, I mean, my broad sense anyway, just as a general point, is that people are mainly interested in their own situations and that of their nearest and dearest and so on, rather than the fate of nations, etc. So I think on the whole, that first narrative of improved living standards tends to outweigh relative economic decline in terms of how people are feeling.
What about Britain's attitude to the rise of the welfare state? I mean, A Northern Wind is, I think, the eighth book in your series on the social history of post-war Britain. And so this is a history that runs from 1945 through to Margaret Thatcher's election. We're about at the halfway point now, is that right?
Yeah, a bit over halfway in terms of the chronology. 62 is the halfway. That's the aim, yeah. To get to 79.
Sure.
sometimes, you know, like running a race or something, the finishing post seems to get ever further away. But anyway, not to worry. But of course, the welfare state, the modern welfare state, the creation of it by the Clement Attlee's Labour government immediate post-war is a cardinal moment in modern British history. My impression in terms of the late 40s, and particularly the NHS starting in 48, is that people did welcome it. But as far as I can see from the contemporary evidence, they largely welcomed it less because it meant, as it were, in a sort of philosophical sense, generalized sense, universal healthcare, free at the point of delivery, but more they welcomed it because it meant for themselves, it almost felt like something for nothing. And of course it was, you know, there had been people, very poor people who'd had either denied healthcare before the start of the NHS, or it was very difficult to access it, or it was a matter of great anxiety and worry, you know, rather like for far too many people still in the United States today. So it was broadly welcomed. I have a chapter in the new book in which I try and look as hard as I can at the welfare state in actual operation by the early to mid-60s. And there's no doubt that across the board, whether it's to do with Social Security, whether it's to do with the NHS in terms of physical health, whether it's to do with mental health, whether it's to do with housing, whether it's to do with education. But it was still, although intrinsically a good thing, as it were, it still left quite a lot to be desired in its daily practice. It was still very sort of paternalistic, not always in a very good way, in the sense of not listening to people, not catering to individual wishes and demands, treating people as units. And on the whole, that picture it paints is a slightly depressing one. It's still, as it were, spiritually, the welfare state is still back in the 1940s. It's still that wartime feel and a kind of be grateful for what you get given kind of thing, you know, and which is wrong, really, because people, for obvious reasons, you know, we all, you know, taxpayers fund the welfare state, etc. So that really shouldn't be quite the attitude. So I think people were broadly positive about the welfare state, but slightly with a slightly kind of grumpy kind of undertow. But, you know, but that's very British, I guess.
It certainly is. What are the main challenges of studying in such depth of such a recent period in history? And these are histories that many of our listeners will actually remember themselves, that they actually lived through. And there's obviously like copious sources for the stuff you're writing about. I mean, as a historian, what kind of challenges does that present you?
Yeah, no, it does present challenges. And I often think, compare myself as a contemporary historian with, say, being a medievalist, and what an utterly different kind of process it must be. And sometimes I might look at a local paper, for example, and if it's a reasonably good local paper, I might just look at one issue, and even just one issue of, say, a weekly local paper, and there might be three or four stories in that single issue. Which I, oh, yeah, this is interesting. I could do something. I could go down that particular... So there are endless rabbit holes one can go down. So I guess that's one challenge, is not getting completely swamped by the massive material. And my kind of rule of thumb is that ideally something which I note, and therefore perhaps I'm going to use in my book, ideally it has to be both interesting and significant. At the least, it has to be either interesting or significant. And if it's neither interesting nor significant, it's got to go, which helps a bit. I think perhaps more importantly, trying to avoid the trap of nostalgia, because, you know, I'm writing about, say, 1964 for the sake of argument, and I can, you know, just starting, I had my 13th birthday in 1964, and I do have quite vivid memories of that election that October. That was when I kind of got some sort of political consciousness, as it were. But the fact is that 1964 and the fullness of time will become as remote as 1864 or 1764 are now. And so I do keep telling myself that one should be trying to write something, you know, as an ideal, which might be read further down the line by people who don't actually remember 1964. And it's one of the reasons why I do quote, it's not the main reason, but it's one of the reasons why I quote a lot of contemporary material, because contemporary primary source material, diaries, letters, contemporary newspapers, you know, archival material generally, that in a sense doesn't date. Whatever I write will date, but the source material itself doesn't date. And any author, I think, likes to think that their stuff might be read some years hence. You know, it's an ambition anyway, and a legitimate one to have, even if it's not fulfilled. And also, I do think, you know, you mentioned people reading the books will, if they're older, will remember some of this. To guard against the temptation, and also perhaps to warn a bit against the temptation, if it doesn't sound too puritanical, of extrapolating the general from the particular, because one particular person's experience is not necessarily representative. And I had some years ago, when the sort of early on in my these post-war books, was speaking at a literary festival about the immediate post-war period. And I was, I think quite rightly, painting a picture, drawing a picture of a pretty difficult time in those austerity years after the war, almost more difficult just in terms of living conditions than it's been during the war. And there were one or two people in the audience, sort of people in their, say, 60s or 70s, who'd been children then in, say, 1946, 47. And they sort of would put their hand up and say, basically, I've got it all wrong. Oh, it was great then. We had a really great time, you know, and we sort of play with our friends and muck around and we could just get out on the street and so on. And to which I kind of wanted to say, yes, but you didn't have to put the food on the table and so on. But their parents, of course, were no longer alive to give a, you know.
So give the counter argument.
But, you know, we all do it. I mean, I'm sure I'm as guilty of extrapolating from my own experiences as anyone else. And you think about the 60s, where you mentioned your father, and I suspect he was kind of Beatles and Stones oriented and so on. And, you know, as indeed was I. And this is a killer fact, which in all honesty, I have to say, I got from another historian, Dominic Sandbrook. Dominic came up with the wonderful fact that the best-selling LP, best-selling album of the 1960s, was not Sgt. Pepper or Stone's Greatest Hits or whatever it might have been. It was the soundtrack of The Sound of Music. I think that's one of those killer facts that says an awful lot more than just the fact itself, as it were.
Did you spy many parallels between then and now when you were researching the book?
Yes, I think in the sense that it has been hard in recent years, if one's a contemporary historian, not to be quite preoccupied by that Brexit vote in 2016. You know, I think there are the odd dates in history, the odd moments that are so defining, and one starts thinking very hard about the causes of whatever it was that happened. And I think 1979 was one such event, with Thatcher coming to power. And in a sense, I think we still do live in some sense in Thatcher's Britain. And I think that vote in 2016, in my view, it was very little to do with Europe itself. And in many ways, given it was on the whole older people who voted, whether working class or middle class, who voted Leave, in many ways, I think it was a cry against modernity, actually, is my personal take. I mean, obviously, there's other stuff going on as well. But I kind of see that as the heart of it, actually. And in the 1960s, things were changing so, in some ways changing so rapidly, or at least on the surface appearance of things was changing so rapidly. And we've talked about various cultural things, but of course a huge thing was to do with the urban environment, the built environment, and what was happening to our towns and cities that were being kind of completely, well, I'm tempted to say destroyed, as indeed some of them were really destroyed and then rebuilt, but often rebuilt in ways where there was very little continuity with the past. And I think it's some sort of, as it were, psychic level, older people in particular found that very hard to deal with. I think older people found it very hard to deal with becoming a multicultural, you know, and over the years have found it hard to deal with our evolution from monocultural to a multicultural society. And that, of course, played its part in the 2016 vote. The politics of race and immigration were becoming very central by the mid-1960s. So there are parallels. Although in some ways, gosh, it seems a completely different world. You know, if you think a world of what, before BBC Two started in 1964, a world of two television channels, total.
That was David Kynaston. A Northern Wind, Britain 1962-65, is published by Bloomsbury.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.